to just thank you guys for coming and welcome you. We're going to continue and probably finish studying through Judges tonight. And then next week we will start Ruth. So the worksheet for Ruth is in the back there. And if you grab it, you'll be ready for next week. So that is going to be our next 2 weeks. And I'm fairly certain that we will finish the Judges study tonight. We left off last week with Samson. So open your Bibles to Judges 17. Which is where we're gonna pick up. So like I've been saying throughout our whole study of the Judges, this is really one of the coolest books in the Bible, I think. You know, every once in a while, I think it sure would be great if somebody made this into a movie. And the Judges is one of those books that would be really, really, really great as a movie. Then I remember all the other parts of the Bible they've made into movies, and I'm like, second thought, let's just leave it alone. But I've really enjoyed studying through Judges this time, and I hope that you have too. Tonight's lesson is, it's like an end cap for the book. It's more like a segue into 1 Samuel, which, like I said, we're going to put some things between Judges and 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. So keep this in mind, and we're actually, when we get to 1 Samuel, going to go back and review this a little bit. But that's what I think that as they structured the book, as they wrote the book, that's what they intended this last couple chapters to be. Because we're going to see tonight three specific things that are almost like random incidents, but they actually serve a very important purpose. So that said, does anybody have any last thing they'd like to say about Samson, before we move on? You know, Samson died by pushing over those pillars and killing all of those Philistines in the temple. Do you have any last closing remarks about Samuel? We had to close up shop pretty quickly last week. All right, if you do, feel free to throw them out there. In the meantime, we're going to move on to Micah. Now, I put a map up on the board because I want to point out kind of how this happens as we look through this. But look at chapter 17. Micah was not a judge. In fact, he was like the opposite of a judge in pretty well every way. But let's do some reading, and then we're gonna do just a little bit of summary. And I think I lost a contact, so could I have somebody read verses 1 through 5?
Now a man named Micah from the hill country of Ephraim said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and about which I heard you utter a curse, I have that silver with me, I took it." Then his mother said, "The Lord bless you, my son." When he returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, she said, I solemnly consecrate my silver to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a cast idol. I will give it back to you." So he returned the silver to his mother, and she took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to a silversmith, who made them into the image and the idol, and they were put in Micah's house. Now this man, Micah, had a shrine, and he made an ephod and some idols and installed one of his sons as his priest.
This is how twisted the Israelites' thinking was at this point, all right? So this mother lost 1,100 shekels of silver. That's a lot. You know, it's 1,100 days' wages in silver. That's quite a bit of money. And so she uttered a curse about that silver. What exactly that curse was, we don't know. It was probably something like, you know, "Cursed be the one who took my money," right? And then her son Micah comes back and says, "Hey, Mom," what'd he say? Here's that money about which you uttered this curse. You know, I took it. Here you can have it back. It looks to me like Micah is doing something that kids tend to do, which is when they get caught, you know, come and say, I'm sorry. That was my bad. Look like that to you guys? So he brings the silver back. And this is how twisted Israel was. She was really grateful to have this silver back. So grateful, in fact, she decided to dedicate some of it to the Lord by
making a carved image.
Yeah, let's show gratitude to God for this being restored to me, so let's make an idol. And, you know, I guess in her defense, kind of, she does use the name for, you know, the covenant name for the Lord there. It looks like she's actually talking about God. Just kind of saying, let's worship God for this. But, oh man, this is just one of those mistakes. Why? Why do that? Why not just offer a sacrifice? Why not just worship God, you know? Why make an idol to represent God? It doesn't make any sense, does it?
It don't seem like though it's too unfamiliar to them.
No, absolutely not. In fact, in just a second, we're going to see if they have more than one idol in their household. And not only did they make an idol, but who did they ordain as priests?
One priest.
Yeah, one of his sons. Which I'm going to put a star up on the board where Ephraim is in case you can't read it. But who are the priests supposed to come from?
Levi,
right? So, are they worshiping God the right way?
No.
No. Are they selecting the right people to worship God? No. What do you call this when you know how you should do something but you do it a different way instead?
Sacrilege.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
Blasphemy.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. I mean, if nothing else, it's certainly disobedience, right? Like, if you tell your child, put all your toys in your toy chest, and they go and they put them in the bathtub, have they know what you said? If not, you know. This is disobedience, plain and simple. Let's pick up in verse 6, and if I could have another volunteer read verses 6 through the end of the chapter. Yeah.
In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem of Judah, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite and was staying there. The man departed from the city of Bethlehem of Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. Then he came to the mountains of Ephraim to the house of Micah as he journeyed. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" So he said to him, "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem of Judah, and I'm on my way to find a place to stay." Micah said to him, "Dwell with me, and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance." So the Levite went in. Then the Levite was content to dwell with the man. And the young man became like one of his sons to him. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as a priest."
So here again, we have one of those head-rubbing incidents. So this gentleman came from Bethlehem, or Benjamin, excuse me, Bethlehem of Judah. And he was a Levite who was just sort of bouncing around. Wherever he could stay, he was staying, right? So Micah found this gentleman, and what did Micah have him do?
Just priest.
Yep. And what was Micah's reasoning in verse 13?
The Lord would be good to him because he had a Levite as a priest.
Yeah, now the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as the priest. Again, what's the problem here? Yeah.
He's doing things just the way he thinks.
His way.
He's just kind of making it up as it goes along, right? And I think this really ties into verse 6. In those days, there was no king in Israel, so what did everybody do?
Whatever
was right in their sight. So was Micah the only one in Israel making decisions like this?
No.
Absolutely not. Everybody was just doing whatever they saw fit to do, whatever they thought worked well for them. And keep verse 11 in mind. In verse 11 it says, the Levite was content to dwell with a man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. Keep this in mind, because again, this is one of the statements that's going to show us just how twisted, you know, this whole situation becomes. So this Levite now is serving in the house of Micah, and they are using this idol to try to worship God, it seems. And the condition of Israel was such that pretty well everybody's kind of following this do-whatever-you-want-to-do kind of lifestyle. So, as this is going on in chapter 18, And you may remember as we were looking at the allotment of the tribes that we noticed how Dan was in two places. I'm pretty sure this is where that happened. In fact, I think this is most likely where that happened. But look at chapter 18. And let me have a volunteer read the first six verses.
In those days Israel had no king, and in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking a place of their own where they might settle, because they had not yet come into an inheritance among the tribes of Israel. So the Danites sent five warriors from Zorah and Eshtal to spy out the land and explore it. These men represented all their clans. They told them, "Go explore the land." The men entered the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah, where they spent the night. When they... Let's see, I lost my place. When they were near Micah's house, they recognized the voice of the young Levite, so they turned in there and asked him, "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? Why are you here?" He told them that Micah had what Micah had done for him, and said, "He has hired me, and I am his priest." Then they said to him, "Please inquire of God to learn whether our journey will be successful." The priest answered them, "Go in peace. Your journey has the Lord's approval."
All right. So we've got these Danites, these people from the tribe of Dan. And they're honestly, they're kind of bouncing around trying to find a place to settle. Mostly because the Philistines, whom they were supposed to drive out of their land, they hadn't. The Canaanites were still troubling them. And by this point, they were relegated to the hilly area of that small allotment they had over on the coast, which, you know, the reason they probably wound up here in Ephraim is because this happens in the hilly area of Ephraim, and Dan and Ephraim border on each other. So they probably are just beginning this journey to try to find a new place, and as they set out from Dan, they wind up there in Ephraim. And it says they recognize the voice of this Levite. So what does that mean?
Think they had an accent, or do you think they were related?
Well, my understanding would be that they had met him before. Probably. That they knew him from somewhere. Which, again, makes sense, because we just read that the Levite himself was kind of just sort of going around looking for a place, and when somebody feed him, he'd settle down for a while, and then he'd look for the next place, I guess, when the food dried up, right? So they ask him, "What are you doing here?" And in verse 4, I think that's a 4, what did he answer?
Said that this man had hired him to be his priest.
I've been hired. Right? Been hired to be this priest. So they ask him to inquire of God as to whether or not they'll be successful. And what does he say?
He said, "Go in peace. Your journey has the Lord's approval."
Yeah. Yes. You're going to succeed. Now, I don't want to make too big a deal of this. We don't read that he didn't actually, inquire of God. But I have a hunch that if he did actually inquire of God by going to the idol he was serving, right, in the house of an idol worshiper who hired him, that it probably wasn't God who answered. Does that make sense? I don't know if I would trust him. With the hindsight we have of Scripture, I don't know that I would trust his answer. Go in peace. In fact, this is kind of the pattern that Paul warned the New Testament Christians about with false teachers. Paul's biggest bone to pick with false teachers is that they did it for the money. Right? They would tickle people's ears because it would get them money. And that seems to me to be what's kind of going on. So the Danites, chapter 18... continues. The Danites continue and they come to this place, Laish. Now, Laish is up in that northern region, and that's where the tribe of Dan kind of winds up. And again, you can kind of see how all of this is perfectly like right in line there with Laish and the new tribe of Dan. So they go to this place in Laish, and they come back and report it's a good land. It's far away from help, so when we attack it, no one will be there to help it. And it's full of plenty, and the people are peaceful. We'll be able to take him. So in verse 11, 600 of the Danite warriors go and they take over this place in Laish. And as they were going to scout out the country of Laish, let me have a volunteer read verses 14 through 20.
Then the five men who had gone out to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their brethren, do you know that there are in those houses
ephod works, I guess.
Household idols and carved images, and a molded image. Now therefore consider what you should do. So they turned aside there and came to the house of a young Levite man, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. The 600 men armed with their weapons of war, who were the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. Then the five men who had gone to spy out the land went up. Entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. The priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. When those men went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image, the priest said to them, what are you doing? And they answered to him, be quiet, put your hand up over your mouth, and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. It is better for you to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to the tribe and a family in Israel. So the priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod, the household idols, and carved image, and took his place among the people.
Okay. So for one, three times there in that chapter, did you guys see where it says he took the idols and the carved image? So was there just this one idol in Micah's household? Well, Micah was an idol worshiper. You know, his household was full of these things. Then the 600 men, where did they stand?
At the gate.
You know, they're sort of it seems like a threatening force, you know. Be ready if you give us trouble. There's 600 armed men. And who went into the house?
The five spies.
The five spies who knew this Levite and had talked to him before. And they went in, they gave him a proposition. They said, is it better for you to serve one man or to come and be a priest to a tribe of, you know, a whole tribe of Israel? And is it better there literally means it's profitable. And it says in verse 17... where was the priest standing through all this? At the entrance of the gate. Now, let's put this in perspective. How did Micah treat this priest? Yeah, it says he became like one of his sons to him, right? If you guys were hanging out at a like your father's house, or maybe somebody who was a father figure to you, and a bunch of armed robbers came to the door, and were like, we're going to go in and take your dad's stuff. Would you go stand with the robbers? Would you go take their side against somebody who's taken you in and treated you like family? And, you know, I mean, you might not want to get involved. You might not want to fight. You might not want to put yourself in danger. But why would you ally yourself with the people who are coming to take and rob and take advantage of this man who treated you like family? And yet it says when they told him this, his heart was glad. Why was his heart glad?
More money.
He's getting a promotion. You know? Yeah. Money here meant more to him than this relationship he had with Micah. Which...
in verse 20 said he took the stuff.
Yeah. He's carrying out the door. You know? I mean, what do you guys think about this? Are there any comments or questions?
He was ready to go.
He was.
Just selfishness. I mean, you know, you see there's no alliance, no appreciation. I mean, surely Micah wasn't doing what was right in God's eyes, but he had never done this man wrong. He'd only done this man good, and that's the repayment that he got was, you know, he just wouldn't appreciate it.
Yep. There's no loyalty here on the Levite's part, is there? Not to God, not to his friends.
Just loyalty to himself.
Yep.
I've always heard there's no honor between thieves.
That's true. This certainly looks that way. And you know, in all honesty, on the false teacher note, this was Paul's problem with false teachers too, wasn't it? The first side of money, they'd cut and run, and they'd leave the church out to dry. You know. So this is what's going on here. So Paul wasn't the first one to encounter that problem. Although I will say this, the silver that was made from that idol, what kind of silver was it? Look back at chapter 17, verse 2.
Consecrated?
It was cursed.
Yeah.
So you maybe could have seen something bad happening to the guy who made an idol out of it, right?
He might have been getting what he got the right way. He didn't do anything right.
Yep.
So the Lord wasn't with him. And maybe he's like, oh. Now I'm getting the same way that I was treated, maybe.
I think so. I think that's part of the point of this event here, because it doesn't really involve a judge, but it does show us that there was no law in the land that anybody was following. No sense of morality or loyalty. I mean, by this point in Israel's history, just total lawlessness. And we'll see in the next account, Dutch, that your comment you just made becomes even more relevant. Are there any other comments or questions before we move on here? I did forget to mention Micah does kind of give chase, and they turn around to him and they say, "You know, stay quiet or else you're going to get roughed up." So I guess what's really bad about this whole situation is that it's Israelite against Israelite. You know, and we're going to see this even more graphic, in a more graphic way here in a minute, but it's Israelites, it's not just the enemies that are persecuting him anymore. They are officially all against each other. Let's look at chapter 19. And actually here, I'd like to have somebody look back at Genesis 19. And I was planning on doing some reading here, but I've got one eye tonight. Yeah. I can squint. Genesis 19. And if I could have a volunteer, this is read verses 2 and 3. Now, this is when Lot came to the city of Sodom.
And he said, "Hear now, my Lord, please turn in to your servant's house and spend the night, and wash your feet, then you may rise early and go on your way." And they said, "No, but we will spend the night in the open square." But he insisted strongly, so they turned in to him and entered his house. Then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate.
So Lot found these two messengers from God in the town square, and what did he entreat them to do? Yeah, and why?
He knew what the city was like.
Yeah, he knew what could happen if they just stayed in the square. Which, you know, staying in the square was more than just saying, like, yeah, we're going to have a camp out. That was pretty typical of the time. If you were just passing through, you know, stay in the square, stay at a lodge at the square, you know, stay somewhere.
Wasn't that the most business taking place in the community?
Yes, sir.
Whether it be good or bad or undercover.
Yes, sir. Yep. So press them strongly. Stay with me. So they went home and they feasted and they ate and they drank. And let me have a volunteer read verses 4 and 5.
Is that Genesis?
Oh, yes, sir. Genesis 19, 4 and 5.
Before they had gone to bed, all the men, every part of the city, and saw both young and old surrounded the house. They called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so we can have sex with them."
So what happened?
Lot went out and he said, "Take one of his daughters."
Well, yeah, verse 4 and 5, the men of the town came and said, "Let us have sex with these visitors." Which brings us to verse 6. I want to pay special attention to Lot's appeal here. Let me have a volunteer read verses 6, 7, and 8.
Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, "No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you and you can do what you like with them, but don't do anything to these men, for they have come under the protection of my roof."
So Lot's appeal at first, I mean, he offered his daughters, but first he said what?
Don't do this wicked thing.
Don't do this evil thing. It's not right. don't do this. And then he offered his daughters. And I like verse 9, it says, but they said, stand back. And they said, this fellow came to sojourn, and he has become a judge. That's not familiar to you guys at all. You can't judge me. You ever heard somebody say something like that? Who are you to judge? You can't judge me. Judge is like a curse word these days. Did you all notice that? Nobody wants to judge anybody else. It's only ever mentioned in a negative connotation anymore. Isn't that true? That's what the men of Sodom were saying. They were saying, this guy, he's coming here to sojourn. He's not from here. He's trying to judge us and tell us what is moral and what is immoral and what is right and what is wrong. And I don't know. That's something that I think we should think about when we talk about judging. So it's Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot didn't wind up having to offer his daughters because these two messengers intervened, right? Or God intervened. He struck the men blind. They couldn't see. It's as they were groping at the door in a panic. And so God intervened and stopped this from happening. Now turn back to Judges 19. So in Judges 19, I'm going to summarize the first chunk and we'll read a little bit. But a Levite had a concubine run away. Well, he decided to forgive the concubine, and he went to retrieve her from her father's home, and says he spoke kindly to her and took her back. And her father kind of delayed them a little bit. You know, he was going to leave, and the father was like, hey, wait, come on, let's have a party. Let's stay and let's eat and drink and enjoy each other's time so they stay. And then, you know, the next day they went to leave, and the father did it again. And the next day they went to leave, and finally he said, no, we need to go. So as they were traveling, they had the option of staying with foreigners or staying with Israelites. And the Levite said to his servant, who recommended they stay with the foreigners, let's stay with Israelites, let's stay with our countrymen. You know, we're going to stay in Jebus, or the Jebusite territory, I think, which is across from Jerusalem. And so he said, yeah, let's stay here. And so they're staying there, they're getting ready to do what you would do when you're passing through a town. They're, I guess, getting ready to set up in the square. And if I could have someone pick up and read verses 16 through 20.
Thank
you. And behold, an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. And the men of the place were Benjamites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, where are you going? Where did you come from? And he said to him, we are passing from Bethlehem into Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah and I am going to the house of the Lord. But no one has taken me into his house. We have straw and feed for our donkeys and bread and wine for me and your female servant and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything. And the old man said, peace be with you. I will care for all of your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square. So he brought them into his house and gave the donkeys feed. And they washed their feet and ate and drank.
Sound familiar? Sounds like what happened in Genesis 19 so far. This old man came and he approached him and he entreated him not to stay in the square. And again, I think we'll see why he didn't want them to stay in the square. But he brought them back to his home and he treated them well. So they were eating, and they were drinking, and they were, you know, spending time together. Let me have another volunteer read verses 22 through 26.
While they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house. Pounding on the door, they shouted to the old man who owned the house, bring out the man who came to your house so we can have sex with him. The owner of the house went outside and said to them, no, my friends, don't be so vile. Since this man is my guest, don't do this disgraceful thing. Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. I will bring them out to you now, and you can use them and do to them whatever you wish. But to this man, don't do such a disgraceful thing. But the men would not listen to him, so the man took his concubine and sent her outside to them, and they raped her and abused her throughout the night, and at dawn they let her go. At daybreak, the woman went back to the house where her master was staying, fell down at the door, and lay there until daylight.
You know, it's tempting when you're presenting these things, either in a sermon or a class, to kind of glaze over the really ugly parts. But I don't want to do that tonight. I don't want to glaze over the really ugly parts, because I think we need to see how ugly Israel got. Because there's no denying what happened here. They took a human being, raped her and abused her and left her for dead. And that wasn't what they had planned, was it? They planned to do this to these guests in the square. And what's incredible about this passage is this is Israel reaching the level of immorality of Sodom and Gomorrah. And what did God do to Sodom and Gomorrah? He destroyed it. This time, God did not intervene. And when God did not intervene, what wound up happening to that concubine in verse 27?
Well, she died.
She died. And she died one of the most terrifying, gruesome, dishonorable deaths imaginable. There is no sugarcoating this situation. This is where Israel was in terms of immorality. Y'all see how bad it's gotten? So the Levite did something that shocked the rest of the Israelites. I mean, they literally said, he took the body of his raped, abused, dead concubine, cut her into pieces, and he sent her throughout all the land of Israel. And even the Israelites, the other Israelites, were shocked and said, you know, such a thing hasn't happened in Israel before. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty close. You know, this is such a shocking thing, it hasn't happened in Israel before. And you know, at first I kind of want to be glad that there was that admission on their part that this was a terrible thing, but what did it take for them to realize how bad it was?
That poor girl was dead.
Yeah. It took her severed body being shipped to them. You know? And the kids are coming up, so I'll kind of move on from there. But what happens in chapter 20 is all of Israel goes against Benjamin and fights him in war. And the ironic thing, I don't know if it's a funny thing, let me move on to that slide. The people of Israel asked God, and if you did your reading, you'll know the answer to this. They asked God, you know, are we going to be successful in going up against Benjamin? Should we? I think actually what they say is, should we go up against Benjamin? And what did God say?
I think he said go up against him.
He said go up against them, but did they win? They lost. So they went back to God. And they said, well, should we again go up to Benjamin?
Lost
18,000 more. So they went back to God with peace offerings and burnt offerings. And again they say, should we go up against Benjamin? And this time God says, go up, for tomorrow I will give them in your hand. And he does. And I think that this brings up a very practical question. Why did God tell him to go up twice but not let him win? I mean, didn't they ask him?
They had sacrificed
during. Yeah, that's true. It doesn't, at least I don't think they sacrificed until the third time. But even so, did they ask God if they should go up? They asked him, didn't they? And did he say go up? He said go up. Twice, in fact, that happened. Why do you think he had them do that? I mean, at least they were turning to him, at least they were looking to him and asking him. Why do you think that he did that?
He was going to let them suffer and see their sin. He wasn't waiting.
Yep. I think that's exactly it. Just like you said earlier, nobody here was right. Nobody here was righteous. You know, we pointed out that, you know, everyone in Israel was worshiping idols like Micah was. You know, and we also pointed out the extreme measure that it took for Israel to understand what was going on morally in their nation. None of them were right. And so it's God. Did God have to be with any side here? He did not. They had broken their covenant. You know, he was well within his rights to not keep his covenant with them. He does, actually, and that's the shocking thing. I think that's the most surprising thing, is that he did give them victory, but nobody in the situation was right. I guess that you have a comment?
No, it's kind of baffling.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit, and it's also kind of frustrating when some people read this, they pick up certain portions of the Bible like this and think this is, they turn it in such a way that they don't want people to trust God or believe in God because of the actions of these people. And it's to me, it's one of the most challenging books to try to reason from, because there is no reasoning with some of the things that happen. They're worse than the Gentiles in many ways. They're worse than the vilest other people on the earth, or they're the equal to them. So,
yep,
it's a challenge.
I think so. They've become officially worse than the nations God said He'd destroy. I mean, there was nobody in the situation who was righteous. And just to finish this up real quick, Israel fought against Benjamin. They finally won, which it is important to note that God did come through. You know, He didn't have to, but He did come through. They finally won, and then they made kind of a pact. None of us will give Benjamin any of our daughters. They don't get to marry anymore because of this, essentially. Well, some of the Benjaminites escaped the slaughter, and they came back. This is in chapter 21. I don't remember how long it was until they were discovered, but they couldn't have any, they didn't have any more women. They didn't have any wives. And the Israelites said, well, we made this pact that none of us would give them any of our daughters for wives. So they basically had them go kidnap 400 of the foreign women to be their wives. When the people from whom these women were kidnapped came up to them, their reasoning was basically, well, we could just kidnap them, or we could fight you in war and kill a bunch of you and take them anyway. And so, again, this is another illustration of how bad Israel had gotten. And I think that's why these three occasions are here at the end of Judges, is the author wanted us to know that Israel had hit rock bottom and even a little bit more. Are there any last comments or questions?
Well, I think the last verse kind of sums it up. It says so in a few other places too. In those days there was no king in Israel, and that seems to refer to the Lord as being king. And everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we kind of see that in our society today a lot of times. There is no absolute standard for right or wrong. It's subjective, it's relative, it's what seems to be.
Yep. It's a downside. It's a down note to leave off on Israel, and I kind of wish we were going straight into 1 Samuel. But keep this in mind as we study through Ruth and then Job, and then go to 1 Samuel. It's not a good place for Israel to be right now. All right, pick up a worksheet for Ruth, and we'll pick up on Ruth next week, and we're gonna try to do Ruth in one class. So. That'll be next week. In the meantime, if you would open your Bibles to Mark 16. Tonight's going to be a very simple invitation. And that is the same one that Jesus gave after He rose from the dead. And I think that it's important for us as we teach the gospel to teach that this was actually being taught from the moment, really from before this, but Jesus emphasized this from the moment that He rose from the dead. You know, He didn't come from the grave and just kind of give a general idea to these apostles for what they were supposed to do. But in verse 15 it said, go into all the world and proclaim the gospel. That's part that I think a lot of people do well. They teach that Jesus lived and died and ministered and then rose for our sins. But He said to the whole creation, and then of course this verse that so many of us know, whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. From the day that, I don't know if this was the day, but from the day that Jesus issued this commission, after rising from the dead, He was teaching people they needed to believe and be baptized for remission of their sin. And that same gospel has been taught tonight, and is taught frequently here, that in order to come into the right relationship with Christ, we need to obey that. We need to believe and be baptized. And like Peter taught, that baptism is more than just a bath, but it's a washing away of sin from your soul. And after we experience that initial washing away, sometimes sin comes back into our lives. Sometimes we filthy ourselves again. And if that's happened, don't let your life get to the point where you are as wicked as Israel,